Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. This week saw Senator Ted Cruz stage a talkathon aimed at defunding Obamacare. Now some Republicans are talking about the potential to default on the U.S. debt, which could have major financial consequences. Some economists are saying that a failure to raise the debt ceiling would be catastrophic. But have we seen these same battles so often lately that we aren't taking the rhetoric seriously? Yet again, the U.S. budget is being held hostage in Washington. Both houses of Congress must reach an agreement on funding legislation by Monday night to avoid many federal agencies closing on Tuesday. Politicians are frantically searching for a temporary solution to keep government running through November. We'll look at the coverage of this story and delve deep into the real impacts these debates and budget cuts are having on people around the U.S. And speaking of cuts, Detroit is the largest city in the U.S. ever to file for bankruptcy, which it did last July. We'll hear about an investigation into how that city went broke and what it means for the rest of us living in cities around the nation. What are the parallels and the differences in the spending decisions that led to Detroit's crisis with some of the current debates around spending in D.C.? So joining us to talk about all of this, we have John Gallagher, who's a staff writer at the Detroit Free Press. Hi, John.
Hi, Holly. How you doing?
And from Washington, D.C., he's on Capitol Hill right now where the Senate is voting on a spending bill, I believe. Michael McAuliffe is the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. And we usually begin the show by giving kudos to reporting or a reporter who's done a good job this week. So let's start with you, John. What piece of good reporting do you want to highlight?
Well, I'm going to stay close to home. I would like to cite our editorial page director here at the Detroit Free Press, Stephen Henderson, who has written in recent months a whole series of eloquent and even courageous editorials about Detroit's situation, pointing out that this is a real thing that the city needs to overcome and really needs to reform in major ways. I say it's courageous because so many people in the city still think it's just kind of a phony plot cooked up by the governor to, you know, take over the city and break the unions. And Stephen's been out front saying, no, the situation is really as dire as the bankruptcy filing would indicate. So kudos to him.
Kudos to him and kudos to you for your big investigation into how Detroit went bankrupt. I believe that in the news today is that the feds are going to give a $100 million grant to Detroit.
Well, not quite. What they're going to do is try to repurpose a lot of grants and some foundation money, and the number they're using is about $300 million. The news conference is actually going on right now, so we'll get some more details. But this is not sort of a new bailout or anything. This is they're taking all the money that they can that either would have come here or possibly could come here under various existing programs and sort of redirecting it, maybe taking some money that wouldn't have been used for transportation and using it for blight removal, that sort of thing. But yeah, they are doing what they can to, you know, absent a bailout, doing what they can to shovel some money this way.
Well, and another big news out of Detroit yesterday, I think it was that the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, wants to freeze the city's pension plan for public workers. Can you tell us what's happening?
Sure. Well, when Kevin Orr is the emergency manager appointed by the governor, sort of a fiscal dictator, and, you know, basically is running the city right now. And he has come up with an estimate that the city's liabilities total $18 to $20 billion. This is debt that we can't repay in unfunded health care and pension liabilities. And so he has said all along that he's going to stiff the bondholders, you know, the Goldman Sachs of the world, who are going to get pennies on the dollar for what they invested in Detroit bonds. And he's also going to reduce the pensions that are paid to city retirees. And these are people whose pension might be, you know, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000. So that's going to cause a lot of pain. So what he came out with yesterday was a preliminary plan which essentially would put most of the burden on younger active workers today who would have their pension plan frozen so they could no longer earn pension credits, and instead there would be a 401k set up. I think it remains to be seen how much he's going to actually reduce existing pensions for existing retirees, but clearly there's going to be some pain there, I think.
Okay, and that's John Gallagher, who's a staff writer at the Detroit Free Press. We'll hear more about his investigation into how Detroit filed for bankruptcy, how the city went broke. We're joined now by Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. He's on Capitol Hill. So we want to give kudos to good reporting to start off the show. Michael, who do you want to give a shout out to?
Well, I've been so immersed in this government fight that I've been mostly reading our own stuff. But we had a really nice story by Amanda Turkle and Dave Jamieson.
Saw that.
It looks at federal workers who have had to face sequester already, some of them losing more than $1,000 from their paychecks, and these are not well-paid people. And now with the government shutdown, they could easily lose like another $1,000. So you just imagine chopping $2,000 or $3,000 out of your paycheck just because Congress can't function.
Yeah, we've got a link to that at yourcallradio.org, and we're going to delve deeper into what's happening on Capitol Hill right now. Yesterday, interestingly, the debate shifted from the possible government shutdown to the debt limit, which is currently at, what, $16.7 trillion. And you wrote an article, Michael, that that's the maximum amount that Congress has authorized the Treasury Department to borrow in order to pay for spending that Congress has already authorized. It's not like a credit card. So we've seen this political battle over a potential default on the financial obligations of the U.S. government. What's new now? What's happening?
Well, what's new now? An odd thing happened not very long after I wrote that story, which is that even in the base of the Republican Party in the House, members started getting unhappy with that proposal. They didn't think, on the one hand, that it was good enough or solid enough or I guess tough enough on Obamacare, and with some other people questioning the wisdom of it altogether, and they pulled it from their sort of unofficial agenda. And to quote folks who I spoke to today, it's sort of on the shelf. So you have a really difficult and, for a reporter, interesting divide that's growing wider in both the House and the Senate on the Republican side that's going to make all of this sort of financial legislation really difficult.
And so we'll get to the government shutdown in a minute, but I was curious about the reporting on that, some Republican demands about, okay, we're not going to raise the debt ceiling unless you delay Obamacare by a year, all of these kind of demands. And all of the reporting said that this happened behind closed doors. And I just am wondering, what the heck does that mean?
Well, in some cases, it's just people making their story sound better. But what happens every week is the House Republicans and the Democrats, they meet behind closed doors for a caucus meeting, or as they call it, a conference meeting in the House Republicans. I don't know why. And that's a private meeting, so it's behind closed doors. And, of course, there's also conversations that go on out of everyone's sight between folks before and after that meeting on how they're going to proceed. So that's when they say closed doors, that's really what that means.
And so in terms of this government shutdown that might happen on Tuesday, where are we now? What's happening?
Well, right now, as we're speaking, the Senate is voting to pull out the objectionable provisions to Democrats on Obamacare. And I suspect within about 15 or 20 minutes, they'll send that, they'll be done with that and send it on over to the House. However, the House is somewhat in disarray, and they have already gone home for the day. They came in, they voted on renaming three federal buildings, and they left.
They went home?
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't go home. They went to their Washington, D.C. homes. They'll be back in Saturday and Sunday, we presume. At least that's the plan.
But why aren't they there now? If we've got this looming crisis, that seems so odd.
Well, it does seem odd, and a lot of reporters asked members who were willing to talk to reporters today about that, and they were like, well, let's see what the Senate sends us, and we'll look at the actual legislative language and things like that. But, I mean, we've known for several days now exactly what was going to come back, so it's mostly been a dodge to not talk about it. And the real problem is they don't know what they want to do. They don't know how to present a unified front to come back to the Senate or come back with new legislation to the Senate on how they want to proceed. So they don't even have meetings scheduled today. At least there's not one big group meeting. There's little side ones here and there. But they don't even have a caucus-wide meeting set for today. So it's going to be private conversations and then more tomorrow, and then we'll see what they try to take up.
And so what would actually happen if there is a shutdown, a government shutdown?
Well, anything that's deemed non-essential has to stop. You know, I mean, the most sort of basic things are like, you know, parks, you know, visa services. I mean, you know, there's a whole litany of things. You know, the offices here on the Capitol close unless you're deemed essential. Law enforcement keeps going, FBI, that sort of thing keeps functioning. But all those little things that you need, there's probably layoffs in places like the FAA, so you'll start winding up with, you know, flight delays and things like that. It ripples out across the whole government, and things sort of gradually get more difficult and more inconvenient, mostly for the American public.
And John, let me ask you, how are people in Michigan preparing for this potential shutdown?
Well, I think that I guess I would say that, you know, even the most diehard liberal progressive believer in big government is pretty disgusted with the way things are going in Washington and how dysfunctional it is. So I think that I don't think people are preparing for it, except, you know, they sort of think it's out there. They think it'll probably be settled at the last minute in some fashion. That may be why people are not taking it as seriously as they should. I mean, I certainly think it's probably going to happen. I think it'll create a lot of pain. But I don't think it's on the radar screen in sort of, oh, we have to start preparing for it at this point.
Even though we're talking just a couple of days.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the people involved, I mean, the military bases here and that sort of thing are certainly got their game plans together. But I just think, you know, people are so focused on the Detroit bankruptcy that they can't quite worry about what's happening nationally right now.
Interesting, just on the, you mentioned the military bases. There are some Republicans in the House who are saying, well, let's just try and delay it one more day so that those next round of military paychecks can go out, because they don't necessarily want to feel that pain. That would hit pretty immediately.
Yeah.
And in a Pew study, it says that the federal budget accounts for about 30% of state revenues, making it the largest single source of money for many states. So, John, let's hear a little bit more about your investigation into what happened in Detroit, which filed for bankruptcy in July. Your paper reported that U.S. bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes will hold a trial next month that will determine whether the city is eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection. And you wrote, Detroit is broke, but it didn't have to be. An in-depth Free Press analysis of the city's financial history back to the 1950s shows that its elected officials and others charged with managing its finances repeatedly failed or refused to make tough economic and political decisions that might have saved the city from financial ruin. So tell us kind of what's the essence of what you found out about how...
Sure. Well, when this all started, I would have said, along with a lot of others, that the reason why Detroit is broke is because of all those long-term urban trends that we know about, the loss of factory jobs beginning in the sort of in the 70s and 80s and 90s to, you know, the American South or Mexico or whatever, suburban sprawl, where the city residents picked up and moved out to the bedroom communities in the suburbs, you know, white flight, redlining, and all those sort of long-term urban trends. But then the more we got into it, my reporting partner, Nathan Bomey, and I, looking at city financial records going back to the 50s, the more it became apparent that the city government in Detroit made a lot of mistakes. I mean, they didn't right-size the city when we started to lose population. The city's two pension funds, one for police and fire, the other for general city workers, paid bonus checks. I mean, something like $1 billion over 25 years went out of the pension funds to pay these bonus checks that they were not required to pay, but that they wanted to sort of tip the workers and retirees because they thought they needed a bonus, and because the funds were mainly administered by union trustees. And lots and lots of just really inept management. I mean, estimating that, you know, incentivizing a new auto factory that they thought would cost them, you know, $2 million, cost them $40 million. I mean, really inept management across multiple administrations, raising taxes to the highest level in the state of Michigan, and just borrowing to pay current bills, borrowing very heavily in the bond market just to pay, you know, cover deficits and so on. And so, you know, we say that if we were not in bankruptcy, we're not saying we would be, you know, some urban nirvana, but we might be Cleveland or Buffalo or St. Louis, which are also distressed cities, but we wouldn't be in bankruptcy court. That could have been avoided with better and more courageous fiscal management of the city.
And John Gallagher is a staff writer at the Detroit Free Press. You're listening to the Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar. We're also joined by Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post, and he's covering the standoff in Congress over legislation on spending right now. And I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation about coverage of the week's news. The number is 866-798-8255. Are you following the budget showdown in Congress? What do you think about how it's covered by both national and local media? The number is 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you've seen great reporting this week, let us know. How important do you think Detroit's economic crisis is in the ongoing debate about taxes, economic policies, and the role of governments in the states? Again, our toll-free number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. How much do you know about what programs are on the chopping block if a government shutdown actually happens on Tuesday? Let us know. Again, you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org or give us a call at 866-798-TALK. And I want to ask both of you about the parallels between the situations. John, you wrote, Detroit's leaders engaged in a billion-dollar borrowing binge, created new taxes, and failed to cut expenses when they needed to, and that led to the bankruptcy. And as I was reading the coverage of the congressional standoff, that's what some of the Republicans in Congress are saying about the national debt, that it will eventually lead to U.S. bankruptcy. So how do you both kind of compare the two cases and the debates that are going on?
In Detroit, I think that the issue is competency. I mean, fiscal competency. There's a lot of cities that are facing a lot of the same problems, but aren't bankrupt, and they still borrow. They still have income taxes and property taxes. And I think it's a matter of you can do it. But you have to be fiscally prudent, but not in sort of the Tea Party shut down the government sort of way. You just you can be a liberal and a believer in government and still be fiscally prudent. So I think that the issue in Detroit really does come down to mismanagement. I don't think that there's generic Democratic or urban policies that have ruined Detroit and that it's going to ruin every other city. I think Detroit's somewhat unique in how poorly it was managed over the last 50 years.
And Michael, what do you think about what some of the Republicans are saying? The reason that they're doing this is because if we continue to spend as we are, it will lead to U.S. Bankruptcy.
Well, I mean, I've heard that argument. I heard it yesterday. And one of the interesting points about that is if you do precisely what they're doing now, if you shut down the government or if you default on the debt, then you will have brought bankruptcy to now. So why is that any better? And in the process, you will have lowered your tax revenues, you'll have depressed the economy, and you'll have made it much more difficult to climb out of the hole. Now, when you look at the Detroit example, I don't think you could get, even if Democrats had power through both houses in the White House, I don't think they could do the sorts of things that you did in Detroit, because the Democrats have gotten to be a much bigger tent, especially in the Senate, than they used to be. You have some very conservative Democrats. Max Baucus from Montana was sort of the lead on their fiscal policy lately, and a lot of the more traditional Democrats did not like his policies. But they could not pass sort of the classic tax and spend, to quote the right, sorts of things that they might like to. So, I mean, it's already sort of moving in a slightly better direction. I think the deficit is approximately half what it was 4 years ago as a sort of percentage of the greater economy. So it's sort of going slowly in the right direction. And if you talk to just about any sort of centrist economist, they think that probably something closer to what the president wants is going to be more helpful in the long term, even if it takes somewhat of a long time to get it back to what economists think is a healthy sort of debt and deficit ratio.
And let's try and get a caller in before we go to a break. Linda in Santa Cruz, welcome to your call. Linda, do we have you? Hi, Linda. Linda in Santa Cruz, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thanks.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. I'm curious, do any of our Are any of the congressional representatives affected by the sequester? Is there any impact on their pay or benefits?
I believe that there is. They are considered essential, right? Tell us, John, what's the impact on them?
Well, actually, I'm going to let Michael handle that one. But just as an analogy, it's interesting in the bankruptcy filing. The bankruptcy lawyers are considered essential. They get paid before anybody. So sort of the least popular people in the bankruptcy are the ones getting paid up front. But I'll let Michael handle the one
about
congressional.
Yeah, Michael, sorry about that.
Well, for your government folks, if you're considered essential, you have to work, but you don't get paid. So you're putting in the time, and you're not even getting to spend it, you know, with your family, and you're losing the money. So it's rather painful if you're deemed essential.
Although the last time that this happened, they did eventually pass a resolution to pay those folks, right?
Yes, they did. They paid them back eventually. However, the mood is such in Congress that, you know, why do you want to go pay these federal government workers? We've saved this money, and, you know, let's keep it in our pockets. So there's no guarantee that those folks will get paid, either the ones that don't have to come to work or the ones that are forced to come to work.
But to Linda's question, congressional representatives and senators do get paid.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they do. There's a law, I believe it's constitutional or unconstitutional, to change the pay of legislators midstream. Now, I'd have to double check to make sure that holds in this situation, but I believe they do get paid.
And it feels like a deja vu. Michael, we had you on just half a year ago or 6-9 months ago or so. These issues keep on coming up. How do you think that reporters can give context to how people are going to be affected and why this matters and what's new?
Well, there is not a lot of new right now in the fight, except that I think that the right is becoming more determined in a lot of ways. But in terms of the impacts, it's what's missing, and it's hard to describe what's missing. And we've actually done quite a lot of reporting on some of the impacts of the sequester, because a lot of folks don't really feel it. But at the same time, there are daycare slots that have gone away. And there are, there are moms who don't have anywhere to bring their kids. You know, there are meals that are not getting served. And these things have a depressing effect on the economy, which, you know, it's hard to say, well, we would have been much better. It's hard to feel. But, you know, we try to write those stories, and they're out there. In fact, Sam Stein, one of our top editors, just won an award for that. So if you search for Sam Stein on the Huffington Post, you'll find a bunch of great sequester stories.
And we'll put a link to those stories on our website, yourcallradio.org. Do you want to just give us a little bit more about the effects of the sequester? We're going to go to a break in about 30 seconds, but it seems like it's the most vulnerable people who are the most affected.
Yes, it is. Primarily, it's the folks who rely on the sort of government programs to help get food and for daycare and for things like that. But it does stretch across the spectrum. Anything that to the military, anything that requires federal funding has actually been cut and slowed down.
I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. I'm in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Monday. We're speaking about coverage of the week's news, and we're focusing on financial questions, the impasse in Congress over the budget, the potential default on the U.S. financial obligations, and how Detroit filed for bankruptcy. We're speaking with John Gallagher of the Detroit Free Press and Michael McAuliffe of the Huffington Post. He's on Capitol Hill right now. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
All of the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. We also invite you again to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling us 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, what do we need to know about the Affordable Care Act? To open enrollment for the state and federal health insurance exchanges mandated by the ACA begins on October 1st. That's Tuesday. If you're somebody who will be looking for coverage through these exchanges, what questions and concerns do you have? And even before the exchanges open, what effect is Obamacare already having on health care and health insurance? That'll be Monday on Your Call. Rose Aguilar will be back. On Tuesday, we'll have a conversation about the legacy of the foreclosure crisis, and we'll find out who's profiting from the so-called housing recovery that we hear so much about in the news. We'll be speaking with Laura Gottesdiener, author of A Dream Foreclosed, Black America, and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. She examines the devastating legacy of the foreclosure crisis and how much of the housing recovery is a result of large private equity firms buying up hundreds of thousands of foreclosed homes. More than 10 million people across the country have been evicted from their homes in the last 6 years. That'll be Tuesday. Today, we're discussing coverage of the week's news, and we're focusing on financial reporting and the potential government shutdown next week. If you want to join our conversation, we're 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. What do you want to know about the effects of the sequester? Are you following the reporting about the political standoff in Washington, the potential of default on the government obligations? What do you want to know about the fiscal crisis in Detroit and how that might affect cities here in Northern California? 866-798-TALK. The toll-free number again is 866-798-8255. You can also send us email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you want to give a shout out to Good Reporting, let us know and we'll post it on our website. We're joined by John Gallagher, who's a staff writer at the Detroit Free Press and did an investigation into how that city went broke, and Michael McAuliffe, who's the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post. And Michael, so this week in the news a lot was the 21-hour speech given by Senator Ted Cruz in an attempt to try to defund Obamacare. So there was an interesting article on Bill Moyer's website about who stands to gain? What are the financial interests around defunding Obamacare? Do you know much about that? What's going on there? It, does somebody have to gain monetarily if Obamacare doesn't go into effect, or is this largely a political battle?
You know, I actually don't know who stands to gain, but I do know that, I mean, aside from insurance companies who were pretty happy doing business the way they used to, there are some manufacturing companies like the medical device manufacturers who don't want to pay the new tax under Obamacare, and there's some others like that. The tanning industry got a little ding there. I couldn't give you a very good in and out of who stands to gain.
What do you mean by the tanning industry got a little ding?
Well, there was a tanning tax slapped in there at one point. I'd have to double check to make sure it's still there, but yes, they were very upset that tanning salons got a 10% tax or something.
Well, in the New York Times is reporting that groups like Freedom Works, Heritage Action for America, and the Tea Party Express have mobilized in a carefully choreographed and mutually beneficial effort to rally conservatives behind Mr. Cruz's cause. And it talks about how much money is going to political consultants around this. We'll put a link to it at our website.
That's a whole different set of financial gain right there.
Yeah, exactly. Talking about sort of, you know, how the politics are shifting around this issue and kind of the divide between Republicans, I'm wondering, John, because as a result of the financial crisis in Detroit, has the political landscape there changed a lot? Like, what's happening on that
front? Well, I think it's still, we have a very liberal city. I mean, traditionally liberal, with a lot of people who certainly believed in the union movement. This was the birthplace of the modern American labor movement. A lot of the city leaders over the years were social workers who came up through the ranks, educators and social workers, labor leaders. Coleman Young, the city's first black mayor, was a union organizer who had busted heads when he needed to. So, you know, very sort of liberal city. And suburbs that traditionally were sort of moderate Republican becoming a little more liberal as a lot of African-American residents of the city move into the suburbs, and then outer fringes that become more and more conservative and more Tea Party. And the Tea Party is, you know, a strong force in Michigan politics right now. And right now, the most interesting political story in Michigan right now is the, kind of the war between the moderate Republican governor, Rick Snyder, and, you know, and the Tea Party people who keep promising they're going to throw a primary challenger at him next year. So I think that Michigan, you know, really ranges from sort of very liberal, progressive, almost socialist on one hand, and then, you know, all the way to the Tea Party, you know, pretty extreme Tea Party on the other. So I think you get a lot of it here.
And it sounds like that mirrors the national political landscape and the battles in Washington right now. We have a full bank of callers, so I'd like to try and get to as many of them as possible. Let's go to Scott in Berkeley. Welcome to your call, Scott.
Hello. Yeah, my name is Scott Lyons. I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist. And I've got a little slice of the impact of the sequester on people in need. The federal public defender has three offices in the Bay Area, and, you know, they work with indigent people or mentally ill people who have been convicted of crime. And so their budget has been cut substantially.
Scott, did I just lose you? Scott, somehow we just lost you. So Scott's talking about the federal public defenders and how they're being affected by sequestration. So I wonder if, Michael, you want to talk a little bit more about sequestration and how that's affecting us locally.
Yeah, well, it's true. There are prosecutor's offices as well and defenders across the country that have had to cut back hours for some of their employees. And, of course, that means, you know, on both sides that these cases go slower, which puts all sorts of people, victims and defendants' lives into even more turmoil than they already are. And I was just thinking, you know, there are so many ways that the sequestration is affecting people. It goes from things like that prosecution to folks here in Congress to research universities around the country are having to put projects on hold, you know, cancer research, life-saving experiments, and they just have to shelve them, and they may not be able to bring them back should the sequestration ever go away or at least a more sensible budget get passed.
I don't feel like I'm hearing or seeing enough reporting on that. It feels like the sequestration effects are largely invisible to maybe people like me who are middle class.
Well, you probably don't really notice them a whole lot, and that's part of the reason why it's extremely difficult for Congress to do anything about it. The one thing that they really changed was sequestration of air traffic controllers, right? Because upper-middle-class people felt the pain of that rather acutely.
Mm-hmm.
So Congress, before jetting off for vacation, I might add, fixed that particular problem. But when it's a less immediate impact, when constituents aren't calling them up and screaming bloody murder, they don't really do anything. So you leave it to folks to say, well, it's going to shave a percentage point off the economy. That means we're going to, you know, fewer people will get jobs. Those things sound really bad, and they are really bad, but you don't necessarily know that it's the sequester doing that to you, so you don't make the phone call.
And it's abstract, as maybe we as reporters need to be doing a better job of putting a face on some of this stuff. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about the example that Scott brought up, the public defenders, is that there's a constitutional mandate. So a lot of the time, if there aren't enough public defenders, they still have to pay outside people to do that work. And it can actually cost us more as taxpayers.
Well, many of these things end up costing us more. I mean, one thing that I sort of take a special interest in is what happens with the census. And when you cut the census, it's getting cut in the budget already anyway, and then you throw the sequestration on top of it. They can't plan for the next big decennial census. It's an extremely expensive thing, and if they can't do more modern, more cost-effective techniques, which they have to test, then it's probably going to cost the neighborhood of $20 billion to do the thing, and it doesn't need to be that expensive. They're going to cost billions by trimming a few million here and there now.
I wonder if that's the long-term game here in some ways. Hey, we have Scott back on the line, but it sounded like, John, you wanted to...
In addition to the sort of the immediate hit to programs from the sequestration, there's also this long-term problem with the way healthcare obligations are eating the budget. In Detroit, they estimate now that pension and healthcare obligations are rising to, you know, half of what the city spends every year. I mean, from fairly small amounts, you know, 10, 20 years ago. So there's also this long-term problem of, you know, other necessary spending getting crowded out. And I think that's one of the lessons from Detroit. It's one of the reasons why Detroit's in bankruptcy, because their healthcare obligations just got enormous. Something like almost a third of the total debt and unfunded liabilities are unfunded healthcare liabilities.
And we have Scott back on the line. Sorry, Scott, somehow we lost you and I clumsily attempted to continue with your question. Go ahead. Do we have Scott?
Hello.
Hi, is this Scott?
Yes, it is. Yeah, sorry, I'm driving, so it's a little bit patchy here. Yeah, everything you've said is absolutely correct. You know, there are attorneys who will do the legal work for the indigent and the mentally ill, but it does cost more, and so it's a good example of the government, you know, cutting off its nose to shoot itself in the foot, basically. And I just want to say, you know, woe be unto the paranoid schizophrenic who has command hallucinations to rob a bank and then robs the bank, but, you know, he's so mentally ill that they become a problem in custody, but they shouldn't even be in there. They should be in treatment. And it just is another example of how those in need are just not getting the attention unless you're flying out of Reagan National Airport in D.C. So,
well, thank you very much for that, Scott. I do want to ask you, Michael, about this, because one of the stated goals of some radical Republicans is essentially to starve the federal government or to make it so dysfunctional that people hate it. Is that a piece of what's going on here, I wonder? Do we have Michael on the line?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Did you catch that?
Hello?
Hi, Michael. Yeah, you're on.
Yeah, okay. No, just think back to the last presidential campaign where, you know, Rick Perry couldn't think of the three agencies he wanted to eliminate. But, you know, the Department of Education, Department of Energy, these are all things that they want to get rid of. and that's just shrinking government. And, you know, I hate to paraphrase just one side, but, you know, Harry Reid keeps calling them anarchists. And you take that a step farther, they're more like sort of utopian anarchists, where they think that if the government is smaller and smaller and smaller, somehow just, you know, the good folk will all come together and make things wonderful. And I don't know that there's much evidence for that.
Well, Senator John McCain even said he's never seen anything like this in his political life.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of complicated reasons for it. I part of it is the way the districts have been gerrymandered, so that you can only, you know, win in a Republican district if you're, you know, you win the primary, and to win the primary, you go further and further right. It's not as true in Democratic districts, so you have a little bit more diversity there, but then you have the sort of financial interests that you were talking about before, with all these groups who earn money by whipping up the base, you know, so that sort of pushes it even further to the right. So you've got this sort of toxic mix. Add to that just generalized fear that I think that is floating around throughout the country about immigration, about the economy, you know, about the sort of what especially folks on the right see as, you know, their great American legacy, and it gets really toxic really quickly.
I wonder, though, are journalists taking the Tea Party movement and kind of the New Republicans seriously enough?
Yes and no. On the one hand, we write, especially at the Huffington Post, it might not be as true at other outlets, but we write a whole lot about Tea Party leaders and Tea Party movements and efforts and things like that. But on the other hand, they're a small percentage of the country. And I think Gallup just came out with a survey yesterday or the day before that found something like 22% of the country either identify with or favor the Tea Party. You know, so less than a quarter thinks well of the Tea Party. It's the lowest number since they've been sort of identified as such. So it's a small portion of the country. But yet, it's still millions and millions of people, so you end up sort of stuck trying to decide which way to go on that.
And let's go to, we've got a lot of callers that I'd like to try and get to. Let's go to John in San Francisco. Welcome to your call, John.
Good morning. I would like to make a couple of positive comments about sequestration. I realize it's not overall necessarily good for the country, but it does have a very good effect on our defense budget, our outrageous defense budget, where we spend over $700 billion a year on defense, which is more than the other 25 next nations combined. It's just inexplicable why we have to spend so much money on defense.
So, and you think it's good, John, that the sequestration is starving the military budget to some degree?
Yes.
Okay, so stay on the line. I know you had a second part of that, but I'd like to hear from John and Michael about that.
It's interesting. The military budget growth is being starved more than the military budget itself, because I think it's still technically growing every year. The problem with sequestration is that, I mean, if you believe that your military should function properly, it doesn't allow the commanders to be very careful in what they cut. And while Congress is doing this, they're still insisting on authorizing weapon systems and ships that the military doesn't even want. So it makes it very difficult for the military to function in the way that it thinks is best. So even though there's less money going there, it's not necessarily achieving a good result.
And John, what do you think about what John the caller had to say?
Yeah. Well, I think we all have, you know, government programs that we like or don't like, and, you know, we may agree or disagree on the level of military spending. But I think that the issue right now with the Tea Party is that we're cutting programs, as Michael said, with the census and others, that you think of as pretty core responsibilities. Do we really want to shut down national parks, for example? Do we really not want to have an effective census? Those kind of programs. I mean, just government data collection on the labor force, things like that, that are pretty critical to how we run the economy. And I think that, the notion that all government is evil, and even guys, you know, even economists who study the labor force, you know, they're doing something evil because they happen to work for the federal government, I think that strikes a lot of people as a pretty odd concept. So I'm with anyone who says, you know, we can certainly cut here and there, but the notion that you got to, make the federal government so small so you can drown it in a bathtub, as some of them say, that seems to me to be a pretty odd concept.
And John, the caller, I know that you had more comments, or it sounded like you did. Did you want to?
I wanted to make one response, is that if there's any part of our budget that can be served by a meat axe approach, which is normally, I agree, not the best way to go, it's the defense budget, because the spending there is just outrageous. The other comment I wanted to make is that the sequestration also significantly reduces our budget deficit. This deficit costs us a huge amount of money in interest. I think it's about almost 30% of our total outlay for the budget goes to interest. And that budget deficit has to be reduced, because we just are passing on huge debt to the coming generations.
Well, thank you for calling, John. And Michael, do I have this about right? About 80% of the federal budget consists of military spending, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt, and then 20% is domestic discretionary?
That is probably approximately right, at least it's in the ballpark.
Got it. All right, let's go to more callers. Roger in San Francisco, welcome to your call. Roger in San
Francisco. Your audience already knows.
Go ahead and start. Roger, can you start again? Because we didn't quite get you on time. Go ahead.
Yes. What we're talking about here is a difference in philosophy throughout the country. The only answer for it is for people to get out and vote. There are far more people in this country that embody a philosophy of more progressiveness than conservatives, but they don't vote. They just sit on their couch and they just do not take an active participation in our government. You can turn things around. Just get out and vote. And you're not going to change Republicans. They simply feel they're under siege. They feel their country slipping away from them. The demographic change is scaring them. So this is their last shot.
Well, so let me ask, stay on the line for a second, Roger. So Roger says the answer is for people to vote. And Roger, you also seem to be saying that people who don't vote are not making necessarily a rational choice. I wonder, though, if they just feel like they're completely left out of the system or marginalized.
Well, if I could just jump in here for a second. If you look at the turnout in 2008 when Barack Obama was first elected, and then the turnout in 2010 when the Republicans really swept into the House, you know, the difference there is that about 13 million voters across the country stayed home in 2010 who had voted in 2008. So I think there's a lot to be said that if you got a full turnout, I mean, even if you got to 80% of the electorate, you know, let alone 100%, I think you'd probably see a much different political landscape.
It would certainly be more moderate, I think. And if you doubt that at all, you just ask yourself, why is it that it's Republican governors and Republican states where they're trying to tighten up the rules for voting so that fewer people vote?
Well, what's happening in Detroit? How are people reacting to the bankruptcy? We've seen public workers protesting against the pension cuts. What else is happening?
Well, there's a lot of public protest over the whole notion that you have an emergency manager. I guess that's the key issue, that people think that the elected mayor and the elected city council no longer have power, which is true. They don't. I mean, the emergency manager is basically hiring and firing the police chief and city department heads and making all the financial decisions. And people are upset about that, and then they're also upset that city pensions are probably going to be cut in some fashion. And there's even been talk about selling major city assets, like, for example, major parks and things like that, although I don't know that they're actually going to go there. So, you know, people are really upset, and this is a fairly politically active town with lots of meetings, lots of angry public meetings and that sort of stuff. And so I think that people are pretty active. But again, in terms of coming out to vote, they usually vote in presidential elections and not so much in the off-year elections.
And what do you think the lessons of what happened in Detroit are for other cities around the country, especially those with large pension obligations? I know that here locally, a lot of people have been sort of sounding the alarm about these future liabilities, including bonds.
Right. Well, one specific lesson is that you have to avoid what's called benefit creep, where, you know, you have a contractual level of benefits you have to pay retirees, and then it sort of creeps up year by year through various kinds of cost of living increases, through negotiated raises, through arbitration awards. You know, independent arbitrators in a contract dispute with city unions will award more than the city wants to. And the so-called 13th check, which is when the trustees vote sort of a bonus payment at the end of the year because they think they're flush with cash in the pension funds. So you really have to be prudent as a pension trustee in how you manage the money and realize it's got to be there for a long time, because ultimately the city treasury is on the hook for that.
But that's an interesting thing about politics. Politics is mostly short-term thinking, and so what a lot of politicians and mayors are doing, since they can't borrow, they have to have a balanced budget, is they're just pushing the costs into the future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is no question that the culture in Detroit city government for decades has been to somehow get what we need right now and put off the reckoning, as someone said, till tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. There's absolutely no question. I mean, borrowing large amounts and setting up balloon payments, for example, so the first payments are not for 5 years or something, you know, well after the next term, after the next election. So that's definitely been a problem.
Let me try and sneak in one quick caller. Ead in Berkeley, just the question, please.
Okay, just really comment very quickly. I would just like to say that the U.S. as a whole is much richer than ever. It's just the money shifted so up high that only a few people, especially Wall Street and multinational corporation, control it and totally starving the country. The Republican Party and the Tea Party are a bunch of unfaithful, disloyal, not even American, and should be thrown out of office as soon as possible. They only represent the Wall Street, they only represent the multinational corporation, the military-industrial complex, and the American people are asleep at the wheel. Go out like the Egyptians did. Take this damn government out of office. Get your country back. Thank you.
Thanks, Ead. All right. So Ead says to our listeners, go out and get your country back. He brings up the wealth gap. What do you two say to people? What are the lessons from the reporting that you've been doing on the financial implications of decisions made today on our country, on our cities?
Yeah. Well, the caller is certainly right that income inequality is rising, and we know that from the reports that we've been getting for years and years and years. And that's probably a function of you know, the political landscape becoming much more conservative over the last 30 years. I mean, the conservatives and the Republicans organized better and, you know, took over the government and took over the federal court system in a way that, you know, Democrats let it go. And that's probably, you know, we see the results of that. So I think that certainly organizing and voting and being involved politically is, you know, is crucial if you want to get the outcomes you want to get.
And let's give John just about 30 seconds. People have been organizing in Michigan. Is it having an
effect?
Well,
that was, yeah. Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think that I think that the mood is getting more conservative, actually, in Michigan. We have a moderate Republican governor who's facing some stiff opposition from his own party, from the more hard right of his own party. So I think the mood in Michigan is probably getting harder, not softer.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks to both of you. I wish we could have gotten to more of your report. We'll put a link to it at yourcallradio.org. John Gallagher is a staff writer at the Detroit Free Press and did this deep investigation into how Detroit went broke. I highly recommend it. Michael McAuliffe is the senior congressional correspondent for the Huffington Post, and he'll be continuing to cover this standoff in Congress. Thank you both for joining us. We're going to put links to all of your reporting at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to everybody who called. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What do we need to know about the Affordable Care Act? We'll discuss open enrollment for the state and federal health insurance exchanges mandated by Obamacare. It begins October 1st, so if you'll be looking for coverage through these exchanges, what questions and concerns do you have? Who's going to be affected by the health care reform? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.com. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.
You know, I just found underneath your bed in a tin can $8,000 of cash. My mom goes, "Oh, yeah, that's mine."
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Moth Radio Hour, Sunday evening at 6 here on local public radio, KALW. By the way, the Big Bang, the Moth at the Bay Area Science Festival is coming. We invite you to join Moth Radio Hour for an evening of explosive tales of discovery, creation, and chaos. It's at the Zellerbach Hall on the UC Berkeley campus, Monday, October 28th. Tickets on sale at themoth.org. Stay tuned. The BBC's World Have Your Say is next. This is KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. It's the most shared and discussed story online today.
The last three decades, where we've got a diagram showing the temperature increases that have taken place, they're substantially higher. But if you look at the trend, that's upwards. There's no question about it.
Scientists have been telling us for a long time that the world is heating up, but a report by UN scientists says they are 95% sure that humans are the dominant cause of global warming since the 50s. But with this this level of certainty, is it enough to change our behaviour and that of our governments? For more than two decades, we've been told about the dangers of climate change, but consistently countries fail to meet targets. So is 95% enough for you to change anything in your life? We've had 2,000 comments on the BBC website today. You can add yours on the hashtag WHYS.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The BBC has established from senior security sources that in the weeks leading up to the attack on the Westgate shopping mall in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, militants rented a shop in the building. Earlier, senior security officials were summoned to appear before the Kenyan Parliamentary Defence Committee. Karen Allen reports.
As well as the lapses in the security system which appear to have paved the way for last Saturday's devastating attack, MPs want to understand the detail of the rescue operation amid claims of confusion over who was in charge. It comes as a BBC investigation has revealed that the Islamist extremists hired a shop in the prestigious Westgate Mall using falsified documents and were able to stockpile weapons, allowing them to resupply during the attack. They used a ventilation shaft as a hiding place and base during the deadly siege. Security sources have also confirmed to the BBC that during the attempts to rescue the hostages, the gunmen were able to exploit confusion between the security forces.
The Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, has said the atmosphere between Iran and the US is quite different from the past. Mr. Rouhani said the talks on Iran's nuclear program between his foreign minister and the US Secretary of State John Kerry were very positive and hopeful. Our diplomatic correspondent, Bridget Kendall, reports.
President Rouhani said he was pleased with what he'd achieved in New York and his success had exceeded his expectations. He said the atmosphere in talks with Western leaders had been quite different from in the past, and he now hoped for tangible results on the nuclear dispute in a short time period. He said Iran would present its plan for resolving tensions when negotiators meet in Geneva next month. And despite widespread Western suspicions that Tehran has been pursuing a secret military program, he insisted that his country had never had anything to hide.
Weapons experts could begin inspecting Syria's chemical arsenal early next week. The Global Chemical Weapons Watchdog will vote on a draft proposal later today, calling for its experts to start work by next Tuesday. United Nations scientists have said they're more convinced than ever that global warming is man-made. The findings were published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in Stockholm. From there, our environment analyst Roger Harabin reports.
They've reviewed thousands of papers over the years in the biggest scientific peer review the world has ever seen. Today was Judgment Day. The message from the scientists was unequivocal. The Earth has warmed in many ways. Humans are 95% certain to have caused most of the damage. The world faces a 2 Celsius temperature rise by the end of the century unless emissions are drastically cut, the panel says. It's likely to raise sea levels, create more floods and droughts and heat waves, and change rainfall patterns around the world.
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Thousands of people have demonstrated in cities across Sudan as unrest continues over the government's decision to cut fuel subsidies. Police have clashed with demonstrators in Omdurman, which lies across the river from the capital Khartoum, and there's a heavy security presence in several other towns and cities. Mary Harper reports.
Police used tear gas to disperse some 2,000 protesters in Sudan's largest city of Omdurman. It lies just across the river from the capital Khartoum, which was also affected. This is the fifth day of demonstrations, with some protesters calling for the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir. Human rights groups have accused the police of deliberately opening fire on demonstrators. Local activists say more than 180 people have been killed. The authorities put the figure at 29.
A senior bishop in the Polish Roman Catholic Church has apologised to the victims of sexual abuse by priests. The Secretary General of the Polish Episcopate, Bishop Wojciech Polak, said the victims had been profoundly wronged. The comments come at a time when prosecutors are investigating allegations that two Polish priests, one of them a Vatican envoy, sexually abused boys in the Dominican Republic. From Warsaw, the BBC's Adam Easton reports.
Bishop Wojciech Polak said the Polish Catholic Church treats the issue of paedophilia among priests very seriously. He said the church owes victims an apology and deep reflection. However, he added the legal responsibility for such crimes lay with the convicted individual priests, not the church itself. Bishop Polak said the church has no data about the scale of the problem in Poland, but said it was taking steps to address the issue.
The Canadian mobile phone company BlackBerry has reported a loss of nearly $1 billion for the 3 months to the end of August. The company had warned investors to expect a poor result because of disappointing sales for its new smartphones. BBC World Service News.
Hi, this is Manivannan Thirumalai from BBC Tamil. Welcome to World Have You Say.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to the programme. It's a new level of certainty. A landmark report by UN scientists say they're 95% sure that humans are the main cause of global warming since the 1950s. There are predictions that climate change could leave one in five people worldwide at risk of hunger by 2050, increasing child malnutrition by 20%. There are increased threats of flooding, destruction of coral reefs, and of child-killing diseases like malaria and diarrhoea. But will this be enough to force action from us and our governments? Or is a bit of recycling or ditching the SUV going to make little impact? Is it the developed world's responsibility, or do we all have a share? Or is your life enough of a struggle providing for your family that your impact on the planet has to take a back seat? Is 95% enough for you to change anything in your life? We'll hear from people across the globe who will bear the brunt of climate change. Well, thank you for being with us here on World Have Your Say. Let's speak to Jan Gunnar Winther, who is director of Norwegian Polar Institute in Tromsø in the Arctic Circle. Jan Gunnar, welcome to World Have Your Say.
Thank you very much.
Tell me how surprised you are by this report today. Is it exactly what you expected them to say?
Well, I'm a lead author in this new IPCC.